Ukrainian forces appear to have pushed back Russian aggressors from the Azovstal complex in Mariupol.
Today, the leader of the battalion and the leader of Mariupol-style defenders again made a speech for international society asking for immediate evacuation of the civilians.
Plus, VOA visits the line of conflict in eastern Ukraine.
And then we just saw some two Sukhois flying really, really low and attacking some positions of the Ukrainians. And they left.
And later in the program, how Ukraine is rushing to collect evidence of war crimes using 21st century technology. Today is Thursday, May 5th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russia pledged to observe a ceasefire on Thursday in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol, where its forces have controlled all but a steel plant complex where Ukrainian troops are holed up, along with civilians the United Nations is working to evacuate. Russia said its daytime ceasefire would continue again on Friday and Saturday to facilitate more evacuations from the Azovstal site. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv about the developments.
Today was day three of the fightings on the territory of Azovstal plant. So, as I told you yesterday, Russian forces managed to break through and to get on the territory of the plant. But today, Ukrainian soldiers kicked them out. So, for the moment, Azovstal plant is back under complete control of the Ukrainian forces. And today, the leader of the battalion and the leader of Mariupol-style defenders again made a speech for international society asking for immediate evacuation of the civilians because the plant is under severe fire the whole night again and the whole day again. In terms of evacuation, no update on today. We know that yesterday 344 people were evacuated from Mariupol, so it's not particularly Azovstal, but it's Mariupol and four additional cities in the region.
Anna, we have coverage of the fighting that's currently taking place throughout the country on our website, but before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about Alexander Markov. He's a Ukrainian journalist, one of at least 24 who have perished since the fighting began on February 24th. But what can you share with our listeners about him?
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of our colleagues are suffering from this war and giving their lives in this war. Alexander was a very famous journalist and especially journalist in the conflict areas, a war journalist, war reporter. He was working a lot in different conflict areas. Especially in Ukraine, and he was the only journalist on the plane from Wuhan when Ukrainian civilians were brought back at the beginning of coronavirus epidemic. So he was a very brave person, and he started. He joined Ukrainian army at the beginning of the war. Because he already had military experience before. And he, from the very beginning, he was fighting in the Kharkiv region and particularly under Izum. And yesterday, during the fight, unfortunately, he was killed by the artillery fire from Russian side. Just before that, he posted a lot of photos from, you know, those photos who he was able to post, obviously, but photos from the Izum area, and we knew a lot of also about Russian crimes and Russian attacks from his reportages. So he was really a great professional and especially military professional.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
VOA's Jan Busha has been in the city of Zaporizhia, where evacuees from Mariupol have been transported. But on Thursday, he traveled to the front lines of the conflict.
I was almost 100 kilometers from Zaporizhia. I was in the Donbas area, the Donetsk Oblast, the word they use here for province. And I was just like 2 kilometers from the Russian forces with the Ukrainian army. And then we just saw some two Sukhois flying really, really low and attacking some positions of the Ukrainians. And they left. It was so fast. It was incredible. The first time in my life I saw supersonic airplane flying so low and attacking the positions. There were some tanks there. And it's incredible. And it's incredible to see, like, how this war is being fought, you know?
Now, Jan, before we got on air, you mentioned that you had the opportunity to not only speak with some of the Ukrainian fighters along that line of conflict, but also were able to go into some of the trenches?
I did, yeah. I went to the first line of defense. I think it was a kind of observation line, you know, inside the trenches. I spent an hour with them there. A lot of them, they were civilians just 3 months ago, you know, people who volunteered to join the army. The guy who was escorting me, he was a wedding photographer, and now he's fighting there. So, yeah, we were with them. And today it was very quiet, they said. Last 5 days, a lot of clashes, but today was quiet. And it's true, we didn't see a lot of action. Just the airplanes flying and some shooting with artillery.
Jan, I wanted to get your impression of what you saw there, because there has been a lot of speculation that Russia may ramp up its attacks over the weekends so that Russian President Vladimir Putin can declare some kind of major victory in advance of May 9th, which is Russia's Victory Day, signifying Russia's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II.
That's everybody's just talking about this here, Steve. And even there at the trenches, they were really, really worried because today was so quiet. And this guy was telling me, I'm worried because they are planning something. It's nothing. It's never quiet as this. So, yeah, Monday, it will be a major day here. Everybody was expecting something to happen because the war, you know, it's in a slow rhythm right now. Nothing's really happening. The Russians are not really pushing really, really hard. So I think everybody's very, very tense for what can happen on on Monday and where it can happen.
Jan Busha is reporting in Zaporizhia, Ukraine, after returning from the front lines. Jan, thank you very much, and please continue to be safe.
Thank you very much.
A recent survey finds that half of Russians remain uncritically loyal to their country, agreeing that people should support Russia, even if its actions and policies are in the wrong. This compares with 35% of Chinese and 32% of Americans who are uncritically loyal to their countries. This appears to be the first study of its kind to collect real-time data from Russian American and Chinese citizens about the global geopolitical realignment. Those findings are contained in a recently launched Compass Cold War II Index, the work of data firm RIWI and macro strategist David Wu, who was the founder of Unbound, a global forum devoted to the promotion of fact-based debates about markets, politics, and economics. He spoke with VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman, who began their conversation by asking, amid the crackdown of free expression in Russia and the intimidation there, how are they getting Russians to respond to the surveys?
Yeah, so basically, RIWI has developed, I think, state-of-the-art survey technology. This is why, you know, some of their clients include the likes of the UN, World Bank. In the case of Russia, the attraction of our survey approach is the fact, first of all, it's anonymous, and secondly, it's completely random. So basically, somebody types in a wrong address when he searches for a particular website and gets redirected to our site, where basically a questionnaire pops up. Perhaps a lot of people don't fill out these surveys, but enough people do that when we do these things millions and millions of times, guess what? We get a fairly large and decent sample size. And more importantly is the fact that, you know what, since we don't pay people for filling out the survey, as a result, people now have to give us their names, their information. So the whole experience is anonymous.
The index also says 80% of Russians, along with 64% of Chinese, believe that Russia, China, and their allies have the upper hand in the global power struggle, while nearly 3 out of 4 Americans believe the United States and its allies have the advantage. Did that surprise you?
That doesn't surprise me at all. I think people are starting to wake up to the realization that what's happening between Ukraine and Russia is largely a proxy war between the United States and China. And I think, you know, there's no question that, you know, as a result of the U.S. aid to Ukraine to keep this war going, that is pushing Russia ever closer to China. So from that point of view, ironically, Trump went out of his way to basically make sure that the Russians and the Chinese don't get together. I think what Biden has succeeded in doing is doing exactly that. If the Russians are feeling China has money, Russia's got resources, China's basically a manufacturing economy, Russia is a mining economy, Russia's strong in basic sciences, China's strong in engineering. And so from that point of view, if you put the two together, that makes a pretty powerful, basically, adversary for the U.S. Russians are even more confident than the Chinese are. And I think that's largely a reflection of the fact that they think that they are now part of this integrated bloc against the U.S. in this new Cold War.
David, you are a former Wall Street strategist. What's your macroeconomic takeaway from these responses of Russians, Chinese, and Americans as we look ahead and possibly see a war going on for quite a period of time?
You know, I think one of the reasons, Steve, I decided to basically, like, you know, I've worked with Rewe to launch the surveys because we're now living through this disinformation campaign. And then as a result, I kind of feel like a lot of these countries are now being pushed into warring situations that could have been avoided. If you were to just read the New York Times and Washington Post, you would think, well, this is all about political systems, that countries are fighting for their political system. But in our survey, the single most important question for me is when we ask Americans, Chinese, and Russians, what do you think is most at stake in this Cold War? Guess what? All of them say it's our potential economic growth. So apparently, the Chinese and the Americans, Russians, all basically come to this conclusion that, you know what? If they lose this Cold War, they're going to be poor as a result. But that's nonsense, because since Adam Smith, over the last 250 years, if we learn anything at all, is the fact that, you know, economic prosperity is not a zero-sum game. There is no doubt in my mind, this Cold War between the U.S. and its allies on one hand and China and Russia on the other, there is not going to be any winner in this. It's going to be both sides are going to lose. And to the extent that we can do anything by bringing facts to the table to help people to raise visibility and awareness about the issues, about the disconnect between reality and perception, then we perhaps are doing a public service.
David Wu is the founder of Unbound, a global forum devoted to the promotion of fact-based debates about markets, politics, and economics. He was speaking to VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The Holocaust is at the center of a growing diplomatic row between Moscow and Jerusalem. This week, Russia accused Israel of supporting what Moscow describes as the neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov angered Israelis when he said that even Jews like Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky can be anti-Semitic and that Hitler had Jewish blood. On Thursday, according to Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, Putin has apologized for Lavrov's remarks. Meanwhile, an estimated 500 Ukrainian Holocaust survivors have had to flee their homes once more for the second time in their lives. Linda Gradstein has that story.
The Holocaust, when 6 million Jews were killed by the Nazis during World War II, has been repeatedly invoked by both Russia and Ukraine since the Russian invasion began in late February. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is Jewish, says that Russia is betraying the lessons of the Holocaust.
After the death by Russian shelling of ordinary people who had survived Nazi occupation and Nazi concentration camps, such an anti-Semitic remark by their minister shows that Russia has forgotten all the lessons of World War II.
Among those who will never forget are Holocaust survivors like Riva Tripilska, a 94-year-old who fled Kyiv for Israel a few weeks ago. In 1941, she fled to Uzbekistan to escape the Nazis. Now fleeing her home again decades later, Riva brought one small bag containing only a few of her beloved books.
I never thought this would happen again. After World War II ended and Hitler was defeated, the good people won. There was supposed to be peace in the world and no more anti-Semitism. Nothing.
Riva and 260 other Holocaust survivors were among the more than 3,000 Ukrainian Jews flown to Israel from Moldova recently by the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Approximately 15,000 Ukrainian and Russian Jews have been brought to Israel by humanitarian organizations and NGOs. Most of the Holocaust survivors are in their 80s and older, and the move to Israel can be challenging.
They didn't accept that the home, their life will be in fire. But literally, the home is in fire now. And Israel should be their second home. There wasn't refugees in Ukraine. There was peacefully citizens that lived their life, but they lost everything in one moment.
85-year-old Valery Bendersky was a young boy when he fled Kharkiv and went to Kazakhstan during the Holocaust. Now he's been forced to escape again to Israel with his daughter and cat. He plays a guitar given to him when he arrived and sings a song he wrote about being a two-time refugee.
We are refugees, a sad scene. Having abandoned everything and with horror in our soul, we fled from Putin, from Ukraine, the same way I once fled from Hitler.
Bendersky says he made a new life for himself once, and now he's determined to start over again. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Petah Tikva, Israel.
With the help of international experts, Ukraine is rushing to collect evidence of widespread war crimes, using 21st century technology to bring the perpetrators to justice. VOA's Veronica Baldarus Iglesias has more.
More than 50,000 police officers have been deployed to the combat areas of Ukraine. They're not just working to repel Russia's invasion. They're also investigating crimes. War crimes, says Yevhen Yenin, Ukraine's first deputy interior minister.
Almost 21,000 criminal proceedings have been filed for crimes committed under martial law. Among them are almost 9,000 criminal proceedings on the facts of crimes committed on the territory of Ukraine by servicemen of the armed forces of the Russian Federation and their accomplices.
A mission of experts tasked by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe found what they call clear patterns of international humanitarian law violations. Professor Wolfgang Benedict chaired the mission.
There have been cases of killings, there have been cases of torture, there have been cases of rapes.
Dangerous conditions prevented them from working on site, but they didn't need to. There's a vast digital record.
There is practically everything visible on the internet in form of videos, in form of pictures, or also in testimonies of victims.
21st century forensics are helping Ukraine's Prosecutor General Irina Venediktova too. She has gathered thousands of photos and videos by crowdsourcing through an official website.
Social media is very important too, because we can use these open resources, and we have the team of near 100 prosecutors who work with open resources. And for us, very, very useful to analyze this information.
But making these images admissible in a trial is the goal of the British charity behind the Eyewitness to Atrocities app. The app collects the time, location, and other verification data that prosecutors can take to court. Wendy Betts is the charity's director.
First is where and when the footage was taken, making sure that we know that information, making sure the footage hasn't been edited so its integrity is intact, and making sure that we could trace the lifespan of that footage to know that nobody had any access to make any changes.
It's a tsunami of information that the Ukrainian authorities need to comb through. The United States is helping protect this motherlode from hackers, says Clint Williamson, former U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues.
The war that's being fought in the information sphere is just as active as what's going on the ground. We're trying to provide a wide range of support to the Ukrainian authorities to help them deal with all the contingencies that they're going to confront as they look into these crimes.
At the United Nations, prosecutor Karim Khan of the International Criminal Court told VOA that tech isn't a substitute for older forensic tools, but it extends the power of human recollection.
You can imagine a witness very often traumatized. With the passage of time, their memories naturally may change, may falter. If forensic evidence is collected properly, it's more capable to be viewed as reliable once it's been tested and it's been looked into.
It may take years before the evidence reaches the criminal court. Russian authorities who deny war crimes didn't respond to numerous interview requests. There are allegations of war crimes by Ukrainian nationals, though far fewer. The Ukrainian prosecutor general Venediktova told VOA she will investigate and cooperate with the International Criminal Court. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of Ukrainians fleeing their war-torn country have come to the U.S.-Mexico border in Tijuana to seek entry into the United States on humanitarian grounds. VOA's Celia Mendoza traveled to Tijuana to hear their stories and has this first of two reports.
We must go another place again and again, and that's why we want to go so far, because it's the third time.
Three times now, 36-year-old Olga Smirnova has been displaced because of fighting in Ukraine. In 2014, she abandoned her hometown of Luhansk for Kyiv due to the war in the Donbas. This year, on February 24th, when the Russian invasion began, she fled to Czech Republic with her husband and her 6-year-old daughter. Now she's in Mexico in the border city of Tijuana, where she and her family are waiting to enter the United States.
And I can be one of 100,000.
The Biden administration has promised to accept up to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees into the United States. And so far, over 10,000 Ukrainian refugees have arrived in Tijuana on their way to the U.S. Most camp near the San Isidro port of entry.
They entered as tourists from Europe through the Cancun or Mexico City airports. When they enter the United States, they will be refugees.
Ukrainians waiting to enter the United States say they feel welcome here.
We took a plane from Warsaw to Cancun. Then we stayed a night in a hotel, and then we took a flight from Cancun to Tijuana. And here we got to this volunteer center where these amazing people helped us and also provided us with food and shelter. And we were feeling really safe.
37-year-old Anastasia Matrosula fled from her hometown of Mykolaiv with her sons, Denis and Dima. Almost a month later, on April 4th, they entered the United States, but she grieves for those left behind.
It's breaking my heart to realize that people can't get out of there. It's really, and sometimes I just want to scream, yeah, to the whole world that save Ukraine, save kids, yeah. So this is really happening.
Just like Anastasia, Olga Smirnova worries about those left behind.
My parents are in Kyiv, near Bucha, near Irpin.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, more than 5 million Ukrainians have fled their country seeking refuge elsewhere. Celia Mendoza, VOA News, Tijuana, Mexico.
And a quick reminder, we'll conclude Celia's series on tomorrow's program. That'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.